Hello, and welcome to Encircled, the Halber Pocket Podcast. Episode 10, the 28th of April. By the 28th of April, the Halber Pocket had been reduced to only 140 square kilometres, roughly six times smaller than at the beginning of the fighting. And in fact, the General Staff of the Ninth Army would later claim that before the final breakout attempt was launched, the pocket had shrunk to an even smaller 15 square kilometres. But whatever the true size, what is clear is that the situation for the remnants of the Ninth Army was hopeless, and that by now, thousands of desperate soldiers and refugees had been reduced to one huddled mass trapped in a small area of fields and forests between the towns of Halber and Märkisch Buchholz. The Soviets, beyond tormenting the trapped Germans with constant artillery and aerial bombardment, also subjected the people to a range of measures aimed at forcing them to surrender. The Soviet Air Force dropped leaflets, loudspeakers broadcast calls for capitulation, and negotiations were attempted through the intermediaries of local politicians and civilians. All to no effect, because to surrender would mean putting your fate into the hands of a vengeful Red Army. If you were a man, you might be killed outright or sent to a prison camp in outer Siberia for a few years, which you'd be unlikely to survive anyway. If you were a woman, well, the horror stories of rampaging Red Army soldiers targeting German women were, by now, well known. Escape to the West therefore seemed like the only option left to people, as it at least represented a chance of freedom and safety. That said, reaching American lines would not be easy, and the journey west would come with its own dangers. Many would be taken prisoner along the way, and many more would be injured or killed. But despite these dangers, the people within the Halber Pocket became fixated on the idea of escaping, no matter what cost. After all, they hadn't gone through hell and back just to give up at the 11th hour. German High Command, meanwhile, kept issuing desperate orders, demanding that the soldiers trapped in the pocket fight to the last man and to the last bullet. Under no condition were they to surrender to the Soviets. Essentially, this order was commanding the Ninth Army in the Halber Pocket to die. Even though Busse had been ignoring the German High Command for the past few days, he still saw this last order as a betrayal of his troops. And after shedding so much blood for the Führer, here, in their darkest hour, the Ninth Army was being abandoned by the Nazi leadership. At 3 p.m., Busse held his final conference at his headquarters in the Forsthaushammer. Even though not all of his senior commanders could be reached, and therefore weren't all in attendance, it was agreed that a breakout must be launched at once. And whilst Halber was now fully occupied by the Soviets, no one in attendance could think of any escape route other than going through the town. But Busse and his senior commanders came up with a plan. To begin with, a strong armoured spearhead needed to smash into the Soviet positions in Halber in order to tear open a breach which the rest of the Ninth Army could then follow through. Contact had been lost with the commanders of 5th Corps and 5th SS Mountain Corps. Therefore, it was decided that the remaining tanks from General Kleinheisterkamp's 11th SS Panzer Corps would form this armoured spearhead. Kleinheisterkamp assembled his commanders and told them to form two armoured thrusts which would plough through the Soviet defences in Halber and lead the breakout west. The northern thrust was led by Kurmark Division, with its remaining Panthers, whilst the southern thrust was led by the 502nd SS Heavy Panzer Battalion. It was behind this southern thrust that the main bulk of the Ninth Army would follow. At the front of this mass, travelling in cars, would be Busse's Army Command and the leadership of the 11th SS Panzer Corps and Kurmark Divisions. Following them, on foot, would be the huddled masses of infantry, wounded, and refugees. Leadership still clearly had its perks, even in these dark days of the Halber Pocket. The remaining Ninth Army forces in the pocket were also given roles in the breakout. 5th Corps were to cover the southern flank of the breakout before following 11th SS Panzer Corps through the breach. 5th Corps then had to take over the holding of the breach to enable following units to pass through. 5th SS Mountain Corps would protect the breakout from the east and northeast and then proceed through the breach. 21st Panzer Division, meanwhile, had to cover the breakout from the northwest before then following 5th SS Mountain Corps through the breach. If they made it through, they were to fall under the command of the 5th SS Mountain Corps and act as the final rearguard for the breakout. However, as mentioned before, the commanders of the 5th Corps and 5th SS Mountain Corps couldn't be reached when the breakout plan was devised. So the success of the plan was already shaky from the get-go. If the armoured spearhead managed to break through the town of Halba, they were to head for the first rendezvous point, the Forsthaus at Marsow between Tornau and Dornswalde, west of the Autobahn near Halba. Here, the lead armoured units were to wait for the rest of the 9th Army to catch up. Once the 9th Army had linked up with the armoured spearhead again, they would all attempt to cross the major road linking Sossen and Baruth to reach the Forsthauswunder north of Baruth. Then, they were to fight on towards the former Wehrmacht artillery testing grounds at Kummersdorf Gut. For the last leg of their journey, they had to cross the final major road north of Luckenwalde and rendezvous one last time in the area surrounding the Forsthaus at Mertensmühle. From there, they could break through to reach the 12th Army lines near Bielitz. In total, the escape route had a distance of around 60 kilometres. Luckily for the breakout group, the escape route was lined with forests, which granted them some cover from the Soviet planes and tanks. But that was small comfort. Their journey would take them through multiple defence lines, anti-tank traps, hordes of Soviet infantry, and a never-ending barrage of artillery and bombs. This march through hellfire would take days, and given the diminishing amounts of fuel, most of the army would have to walk the entire way. But the escape route that I've just outlined to you was not so clear-cut in real life, because whilst a somewhat concrete plan for storming Halba had been agreed upon, the plan for what to do after Halba was murky at best. Yes, important rendezvous points had been designated, but these rendezvous points were simply hopeful waypoints on the map. There was no way the Germans could truly know what defences lay in store for them, and they had no idea if the rendezvous points themselves were even safe for them to pause and take rest at. Plus, whilst the 9th Army divisions could be lined up neatly on a map for the initial phase of attack through Halba, it was understood by all that after Halba, the 9th Army forces which made it through the gap would be nothing more than a chaotic mess of soldiers and refugees. In short, the breakout groups would be a mass of humanity fleeing through the woods. The 9th Army leadership, the men underneath them, and the civilians huddling beside them were under no illusions as to the enormity of the task ahead. The breakout was timed to start at 6 p.m. Given the poor state of communications, the breakout attempt was communicated by word of mouth, with the news spreading like wildfire amongst the soldiers and refugees. The preparation for the breakout was frantic. Any non-essential equipment was destroyed or abandoned, artillery pieces lacking ammunition were sabotaged, and every soldier, whatever role he had previously held in the army, was given a weapon and thrown into a combat unit. As they were responsible for leading the breakout charge, the Kurmark Division and the 502nd SS Heavy Panzer Battalion spent the next few hours desperately scraping together what remaining vehicles they could find. And the results were pitiful. The 502nd, for example, only had 14 Tiger tanks remaining, and the fuel situation in both divisions was so dire that the crews had to siphon petrol from any military or civilian vehicles they could find. They knew that if they couldn't keep these tanks moving, or they ended up running out of fuel mid-battle, then the breakout would be doomed. Right on time, at 6 p.m, the 9th Army fired one final artillery barrage at the Soviet positions in Halba. Once the ammunition was spent, the artillery personnel spiked the guns and joined the rest of the army as infantry. It was hoped that this final artillery barrage would soften up the Soviets in Halba, enabling the two armoured thrusts to punch through, followed quickly by the masses of infantry and civilians. However, the timing of the barrage wasn't exploited for maximum effect, as the large numbers of leaderless units didn't receive the order to march on time or were not able to assemble on time. This meant that the assembled mass of tanks and infantry only finally got moving at 6:30. The tanks led the way, followed by a ragtag bunch of armoured personnel carriers, transport vehicles, ambulances and staff cars. On the edges of the roads and in between the vehicles marched the soldiers, the Volkssturm and the refugees. The Soviets in Halba shook off the German bombardment and waited for the inevitable attack. As the light drew to a close, the lead armoured elements reached the outskirts of Halba and immediately came under fire. By 9 p.m, the German tanks had managed to penetrate into the town, but it was clear from the strength of the returning fire that the German artillery barrage at 6 p.m. had done little to shake the defending Soviets. The German tanks crossed the train tracks leading into the centre of town, and on Lindenstrasse, at the junction leading to Toypitz, the lead tank rammed straight into a waiting anti-tank barricade. The crude barricade, consisting of two rows of chopped-down pine trees filled with sand in between, spanned the entire width of the road, and it formed an effective barrier which the tank was unable to break through. The lead tank was now stuck on this trap, and traffic started to build up behind. This was when the Soviets unleashed hell, with wave after wave of grenades and phosphorus grenades being hurled at the Germans from the surrounding houses. The German tanks returned fire, and all of the nearby houses were soon up in flames, casting a bright light in the darkness. To give you an idea of what the initial armoured assault on harbour was like, here is an excerpt from Oberscharführer Ernst Streng from the 502nd SS Heavy Panzer Battalion. The general issues his orders. Fall in and break through. Clear a way through Halber and then make for the Autobahn. We thrust forwards, over the railway crossing, keeping to the right and heading for a road flanked by trees on either side. The leading tank platoon and my own crew follow. Walls shake, sharp-edged glass splinters fall out of window frames, and the tanks grind their way through the town. All of a sudden, right in front of us, the first shells explode, sending fragments hissing and howling. We hear the dry crack of machine guns and countless bombs hailing down. There is a brief pause in the firing, and the crowd seems confused. Seconds later, soldiers thrust forwards under the protection of the tanks, cheering loudly. Then darkness finally falls, and with it, panic breaks out. Everyone seeks cover behind the tanks or beside the buildings. The Russians shell us continuously. After some 100 meters, the column comes to a standstill. Kunkka radios that he's got about 30 meters short of the anti-tank barrier and is asking for infantry support. I don't have a clear view of the blockade. In the meantime, the streets are choked with trucks and exploding shells. Soldiers and civilians jam themselves in between the trees lining Angerstrasse, which is 30 meters wide. I turn off to the right in order to orientate myself. Enemy shells relentlessly pound the surrounding buildings and the Lindenstrasse. Smoke billowing out from the buildings covers the battleground. Tongues of bright flame leap skywards. Lofts are alight, blazing fires illuminating the ghostly night. The murderous attacks reach a crescendo and total chaos follows. The breakthrough of the Ninth Army has reached its climax. Two Soviet tanks then appeared behind the anti-tank barrier and started pouring fire into the German tanks, who quickly realized it would be suicide to stay and fight. The two leading Tiger tanks were knocked out, but the other tanks in this spearhead managed to withdraw and they instead bypassed the town to the east. Other elements from the Ninth Army made their own assaults on Halber, such as the battlegroup Kraus, which was a ragtag bunch of soldiers and civilians. This group tried to break through via the train station. As Hauptsturmfuhrer Kraus later recalled, "There, in front of us, along the railway embankment, stood a red brick building, occupied by the Soviets who were busy firing at us with machine guns and artillery. Swiftly scanning the area, I found out what I needed to know. Most of our soldiers were no longer carrying arms. They lay down or stood around in groups, stunned, helpless, or having decided to not do anything to counter the barrage. I was not best pleased. I ordered the other officer to go back and rush our troop along, as I was convinced there was a real possibility of breaking through there and then. I surely didn't want to lose momentum. The Russians on the other side and along the embankment didn't appear to be a significant threat. Yet. I gathered around me a few sergeants, soldiers and civilians. I'll take over now. We're attacking in half an hour. That's our breakthrough. In circumstances such as these, half an hour seems like an eternity, but I needed to wait for my men to arrive, as without them, the likelihood of success was small. I then told those crowding around me that anyone prepared to fight, civilians included, should get ready. Whoever still got a weapon and ammunition should shoot the living daylights out of this position. The rest should shout, "Hurrah!" My command, "Forwards, grenadiers!" Needless to say, my officer never returned with my men from where I'd left them, but instead, I could distinctly hear a battle erupting from the woods. The agreed half hour came and went, and I simply couldn't afford to wait any longer, so I decided to break through with the comrades at my side. "Forwards, grenadiers! Forwards!" I shouted. I screamed and charged ahead, and wouldn't you know it, the whole lot of them soldiers, civilians, women, and children started racing after me towards the Russians. They must have been so taken aback that they hardly fired in our direction, fleeing by the hundreds. We stormed forwards, stormed a few hundred metres past the station building, and barely fired a shot. Then suddenly, we realised that we had made it. We had broken through. We had actually managed to cross the embankment without suffering any serious casualties. But heroics aside, there was a real lack of effective leadership and understanding about the layout of the town. To many German soldiers and refugees, it seemed as if the Soviets had a better understanding of how the streets than they did. And to make matters worse, the ongoing sense of paranoia regarding the reported use of Seydlitz troops by the Soviets compounded the logistical nightmares the Ninth Army was facing. As Karl-Heinz Dreimel, an eyewitness from the battle, later recalled, Michalek, a native of Halbe, who was serving as a truck driver with the Ninth Army, arrived near Halbe while the battle was in full swing. He plucked up the courage to approach a bunch of undecided officers gathered round to deliberate their position, and he offered his help. He would, he suggested, lead everyone there around the town. Seeing as Halbe was his home, and he was familiar with its geography, he knew that north of Halbe the terrain was not marshy, that there were no water obstacles. He was prepared to lead the way because as far as he could tell, they, including the tanks, would all cut through successfully. Barely able to finish his words, he wished he had bitten his tongue, as he was instantly suspected of being a traitor. Indeed, such was the horrified reaction that he had to fear for his life. Fortunately for him, however, his papers indicated Halbe as his place of birth. Nonetheless, the officers of this particular unit were obstinate, so much so that they actually insisted on heading straight into Halbe. Nearly all of them perished, including their leader. Further anti-tank barriers had been set up blocking other access routes out of Halbe, such as the one placed on Kirchstrasse towards the south of the town. This barricade acted as a secondary barrier, trapping Germans who managed to escape the chaos on Lindenstrasse. The anti-tank barricade on Kirchstrasse held up breakout groups for several hours and led to truly gruesome scenes where wave after wave of desperate German soldiers and refugees flung themselves at the barrier, trying to break through. In this desperation, one survivor even described how tanks rolled up from the rear of the breakout group and ploughed down this road through the barrier, squashing everything in their path. This included the injured who were unable to crawl away in time. All around Halbe, pitched battles raged throughout the night, with hand-to-hand fighting taking place in the streets, houses, and gardens of the town. Despite their superiority in numbers, the Soviets defending the town were taken aback by the strength of the German onslaught. And although there were catastrophic losses on both sides, the Ninth Army spearhead managed to punch through Halbe, and the final barricade on Lindenstrasse, leading westwards out of town, was successfully breached. The German tanks now drove on towards the Autobahn west of the town, paving the way for the rest of the breakout group to escape. But whilst they escaped, Halbe had been left in pieces. Before we wrap up our events for the 28th, I will catch us up on the progress of Wenck's 12th Army fighting valiantly in the west. The 12th Army now held an area large enough to receive any units who managed to break out to them, whether it be from Potsdam, Berlin, or Halbe. And on their northern flank, the Schill and von Hutten divisions had managed to take the village of Fesch on the southern bank of the Schwielersee. Wenck immediately contacted General Raymond, commander of the Potsdam garrison, and he ordered the garrison to break out to their lines at once. The Potsdam garrison did not need to be told twice, and beginning on the evening of the 28th and continuing into the 29th, 20,000 men of the garrison reached the 12th Army lines, either by marching along the shoreline of the Schwielersee Lake or by crossing it with small boats. Despite their daring escape, immediately after their arrival, Wenck put the men of the Potsdam garrison to work, and he assigned the men to reinforce the Schill and von Hutten divisions. They would be expected to fight, and there was a hell of a lot of fighting still to do. On their eastern flank, the Schill and von Hutten divisions were still engaged in heavy fighting with the Soviets around the Autobahn Dreieck south of Potsdam. And just a few further kilometres east, the Scharnhorst and Kerner divisions had managed to take the villages of Salzbrunn and Elsholtz just south of Bielitz. This meant that whilst the 12th Army was inching closer to the 9th Army, it was having to pay a heavy price to do so. And the Soviets were stalking the 12th Army all along the way, attacking them at every turn. A communication was then sent to the Ninth Army, informing it to concentrate its breakout efforts towards the Bielitz area. Here, the 12th Army would try to hold on for as long as possible.